it talks about he's the anchor, our anchor of the soul. And what a beautiful song. And I wish I had a singing voice. I try. But David and other singers like David, they make it so effortlessly, you know, when they sing. They don't blare out and blow our ears out. They just stand up here and they open their mouth and out comes this beautiful voice. And it's very moving, and what a beautiful song that is. I bring to you greetings from Panama City Beach, Florida, where we have about 200 there registered. And the weather is spectacular there, I have to say. I did not want to leave. I was there at the restaurant. They were sending me off, and the weather was absolutely beautiful. We're having about 65 at night and about 85 during the day, and the sun is out. And there's a little bit of fog in the morning, and it blows out about 9 o'clock, and it is just absolutely picture perfect. They do have weather coming in, though, I believe, Tuesday, so we'll probably see some rain down there. But though it's a good crowd there. This year, I'm surprised that we had about 8 or 9 people. It was the first time they'd ever been to the Feast of Tabernacles, and so I was delighted to see that. We also had quite a few visitors from, I don't know whether they're coming from other groups that are out there. You know, in Panama City Beach and that Destin area all up and down that coast there, there are several Church of God groups that meet in that area because it is a vacation site, and it seems like every one of those big condominiums down there have one of the church groups that are there. So I think there are those that kind of surf, as I say, you know, between the church groups and visit. But our doors are open, and I'm glad that they're there, and I hope that they have a good time. I met some wonderful people from West Indies, the islands, the Caribbean islands. They're there, and some of them was their first time. They had quite a trek to fly from West Indies to Miami, and then from Miami to Orlando, and then from Orlando drive to Panama City Beach. Now, that's a journey to get there. Sounds like some of the trips Mr. and Ms. Kilcheski made going to the feast years ago, you know, by canoe and train and walking and hiking, and however they got there, they made their way to the feast. But it's a delight to be here with all of you, and I can't tell you how glad I am to see your faces. I just look forward to this time so much. I hate the traveling. I hate being in airports, and I hate all of that. But when I get here and see your faces, it just moves me to almost to tears just to see you. And I'm delighted to be here with all of you, and I want you to know how much that I appreciate all of you and what all you do to make this feast happen for everyone. And your participation, each of you, you know, if you're not here, it wouldn't be the feast. I was telling my daughter, we were standing out in the Gulf a couple of days ago, up to my waist, trying to hide most of what is visible to everyone. So I was up to my chest in water, and I was standing there talking to her, and I said, you know, I came to Panama City Beach when I was in sales and traveling. And I came to this very beach and stood on this beach and looked at the ocean. But God's people weren't there. And it wasn't the same. It just wasn't the same. It was very lonely because all of our experiences there have been during the Feast of Tabernacles with God's people there at the feast. So you are the ones that make it happen. And I'm so glad that you're all having a wonderful time here. And this facility is very, very nice. It is really good. And I hear you guys are... I guess you have more here than you had last year, too. And I believe we're a bit ahead of that as well in Panama City. Of all the commandments that God gave us, I guess one of my favorites is the one that He gave that said, you're going to take your money and you're going to save it up and you're going to go to one of the most beautiful places on the face of the earth. And you're going to be there with God's people. And you're going to lavish yourself with gifts. You're going to eat wonderful food. Some of the things that you've been denied the whole year long, I suppose. And you're going to just enjoy the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, that's a real hard commandment to keep, isn't it? Out of all the ones that He gave us, that one's the most difficult to keep, isn't it? Really hard to do, isn't it? In Leviticus 23, God gave this proclamation to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, and I'm sure that one of the ministers probably read this to you earlier, but I just want to briefly touch on it. It said, speaking of the children of Israel, and say, the 15th day of the 7th month, and as I described to the folks down in Panama City, this is the 7th month. We keep the Jewish or the Hebrew calendar, you know, the first month being the month of Abib in about March and April. And if you count from there 7 months, it brings you to October. And a lot of people will say, wait a minute, October, the 7th month is June or July. How are you talking about? Well, we honor that ancient Hebrew calendar, God's calendar, according to the months that He created in the month beginning with the month of Abib. And that brings us to the 7th month, which was Tishri, if you will. He says, in the month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days. And the first day shall be a holy convocation, which you had here, I'm sure. And you shall do no work. In 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. And of course we know that the Apostle Paul told us that it wasn't possible that the blood of bulls and goats could take away sin. So we don't offer those sacrifices anymore. Else I would have to hire about 120 of you men out here to help me get up here and erect an altar right here. And we'd slaughter all these bullocks and goats and sheep. Can you imagine what a job that would be? To have to burn these offerings up on this great altar during the Feast of Tabernacles. And they literally did hundreds of them. Must have made quite an impression on the people, don't you imagine? To see that? To see that smoke descending off of these ancient sacrifices up on this brazen altar of coals and fire. It made a visible impression on them, don't you think? But we don't offer offerings anymore because we know that Christ was our offering, our unblemished lamb. Down in verse 39, it says, also in the 15th day of the 7th month, when you have gathered in the fruit of the land. So it was a fall harvest. And a lot of people wonder, you know, around this time of the year, we have these fall harvests. We drive down from Texas all the way down to Panama City Beach, Florida. We go through Alabama and Mississippi, and there's all these little fruit stands with their pumpkins and hay bales, and it just reminds me of the time of the year, that it is the fall of the year, our harvest festival. He says, you'll keep the feast, and on the first day shall be a Sabbath, and on the eighth day a Sabbath. You shall take on the first day the boughs of goodly trees, branches of palm trees, and boughs of thick trees, and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God 7 days. As I said, one of the most difficult commandments that God ever gave any human being. I was driving through the Walmart parking lot. As you do when you come to the feast, you have to unpack, and then you got to go to Walmart. That's the feast procedure, isn't it? Get all your groceries and get things ready before the Sabbath starts. And out in the corner of the parking lot was this young little Armstrong, Michael Armstrong. And down there in Panama City along the beach are these palm trees and these plants that even grow out of the ground. Big, huge palms that are this big around. And the stems on them are this big. He actually had to go into Walmart and buy a hatchet. And he asked the people at Walmart if he could chop down two of these big old palms. It just so happened when he came out, I think it was a miracle. He walked out, and the director there, or the manager of Walmart, was standing there talking to the groundskeeper and said, you know, it's going to be nice when we get all this cleared out. And just so happened, he wanted to get a couple of those palm trees, so he asked them, and they said yes. So he went over and cut two of these big old palms, and he went and got a bucket of sand from the beach, and he stuck these two palms in there. And I mean, they are 10 or 12 feet tall. They're huge. And we have them sitting in the corner of the room where we meet there for the feast. So it's a reminder of this scripture, how they took these branches and they made these little temporary shacks and shanties. And they took those palms and laid them up on top. And they actually moved into that for 8 days. My wife doesn't want to camp anymore. We camped out. We used to have the compound, as we called it. Because I had about 4 or 5 tents, and my brother and my sister, and I mean my wife's family sometime would come with us. We'd go to the feast. We'd set up about 4 or 5 of these tents. We had a tent where we ate, a tent where we slept, and a tent where we got out of the rain. And we miss a little bit of that, I suppose, when we stay in a nice condo on the 11th floor looking over the Gulf of Mexico. The rudimentary part of that, I suppose, we miss somewhat. And even here in these wonderful log cabins, it's so nice to have air conditioning. Believe me, I love air conditioning. But they didn't do that. They were instructed to build these temporary shacks and out of these palm trees. And he says down in verse 41, "And you shall keep the feast in the Lord 7 days, and it shall be a statute forever in your generation." And verse 42, "You shall dwell in booths." And, of course, my margin says tents. You could say shack, shanty, you know, temporary dwelling. But booths or tabernacles, and that's where the term came from. 7 days, all that are Israelite born shall dwell in booths. That word sukkah is the word there that was translated booths or temporary tabernacles. And you know, the Israelites, when they came out of the land of Egypt, one of the first cities that they stopped and named was called Sukkah. It was the place of tents. That was the name of the place they were. And it says, in verse 43, it tells us why. "That your generations may know that I made the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." God wanted a continual reminder of what? What did he want to remind them of? Well, he wanted them to remember that they had dwelled in these tents out there in the wilderness. And what happened in the wilderness? Well, God had provided everything for them. Their sustenance, they rained down manna from heaven every day except on the Sabbath day. They went out there and gathered their food. He brought water out of a rock. He led them by the cloud by day and the fire by night. And even the very sandals on their feet didn't wear out for 40 years. You ladies would love a pair of shoes like that, wouldn't you? Talk about some good leather. Well, it was under God's protection. They were under God's protection that whole 40 years. And that was what he was trying to impress upon them. That they didn't have to worry about food or water or protection from enemies or the weather. God was their protector. God actually commands us to be here for the feast. Over in Deuteronomy, the 14th chapter, and I'm sure you probably read this as well, but I'll just review it. We can read these scriptures more than once, can't we? Deuteronomy, the 14th chapter, talks about the tithe. And, of course, God instructs us to tithe, and he lays claim to the first tenth. You know, they had, when they marched the sheep or the cattle at the end of the year and they sold their flocks, they had a guy sitting up on a chute there, and every tenth cow or cattle or sheep they went through, he put a mark up on it, and God laid claim to that. And that was actually given to the temple, and, of course, we later on find out, to the Levites to support them in their duties. But he also talked about the second tithe here, and a lot of people have debated whether this was actually another tenth that they were to take up. But if God laid claim to the first tenth, where would the money come from for what he's describing here? And we'll read that here. He says down in verse 25, Then shalt thou turn it to money and bind up the money in your hand, and you shall go into the place which the Lord shall choose. And there, and thou shalt bestow that money for whatsoever your soul lusteth after. And of course, that is within reason. Of course, that means within God's instructions or what God would allow. You're not to go out to some little shanty place out here outside of town with that money. But within reason, within God's laws. For oxen, for sheep, for wine, or for strong drink, or for whatsoever your soul desires. And thou shalt eat there before the Lord your God, and thou shalt rejoice, you and your household. And that's what we're here doing today. And it's been a wonderful example for us each year to come and save up our money. You know, I was talking years ago to this elderly couple that kept the feast. And I was a young man. I just started tithing and didn't have enough money to go to feast 1 year, but I went anyway, and the church helped me to go. My son was about 1 or 2 years old, and we stayed in a cabin over there in Oklahoma somewhere, and some of the people helped us during that year. It was one of our first feasts as a family to go. And he told me that year, he says, "You know, young man, next week when I go back to work, I'm going to start putting money back for the feast next year." And that made an impression on me. I thought, wow, that's planning a whole year out. You know, I was planning 2 or 3 days out. And here he was planning for the next feast. And I thought it was a great example. And, of course, that's what he's describing here in the book of Deuteronomy. And, of course, we know that in the book of Malachi it tells us, will a man rob God, when he's talking about tithes and offerings? As long as they continued this practice, they were reminded of God's divine protection. When they would begin to ignore or abandon or reject God, they began to lose this identity they had with God. And by the way, it was very difficult to reestablish this identity or this relationship with God. An example of that is over Nehemiah, the 8th chapter. If you'll turn there with me. Y'all haven't read this year, have you? No? Yes? No? Okay, good. Nehemiah, the 8th chapter. I won't read all of it. I just want to briefly go over this. I've had a sermon or two on it before. With a little bit of history here. You know, Abraham was a man called of God. He had a son named Isaac, and Isaac's son was named Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. And you all are very familiar with that story. Israel had 12 sons: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. You remember the 12. They had 12 sons that all went down into Egypt. You remember when they sold Joseph into Egypt. And there in Egypt, they spent 430 years, and they completely lost much of their identity. They lost the observance of God as theocracy. And we know that the story, and we read in the book of Exodus, how Moses brought the nation of Israel out of the land of Egypt with all of his divine miracles, and they went out in the wilderness. They lived there for 40 years, and eventually in Joshua's day, when they fought the Battle of Jericho, they entered the Promised Land. During that time in the Promised Land, they lived under Saul, under King David, the Davidic kingdom that ranged all over that empire there, and then eventually under the Solomonic kingdom, under his son Solomon. And for 120 years, they had one of the most prestigious kingdoms in all of history, under David and Solomon, and of course under his son Rehoboam. And you know the story. At the time Rehoboam became king, there was a civil war, not unlike the one that happened here in the United States, where the northern 10 tribes rebelled against the southern tribe of Judah, and that nation was divided, and they became two nations. We know that later on in history, under the prophets, especially those like Isaiah, that prophesied that because of their rebellion and their rejection of actually creating another holy day, a false holy day in the 8th month, which is what the northern tribes did, to keep them from going back to Jerusalem and celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, they created another holy day. They set up the golden calves. And because of that, the prophets warned that the Assyrians were going to come and take them away captive, and that's exactly what happened. And we know under Sennacherib and Sargon and Shalmaneser, those successive waves came and took away those northern 10 tribes of Israel, and they never returned. We know those 10 tribes went away. I was having a long discussion with my son on the way down to Panama City about the identity of the nation of Israel, that little hourglass-shaped little nation that exists there in Palestine today, is not Israel. That the nation of Israel was carried away captive, the northern 10 tribes, about 718 B.C. And that it was over 120 years later, and you remember the story of Nebuchadnezzar and the young princes of Daniel and Ezekiel that were carried away captive by the Babylonians, that were carried away captive to Babylon, that was the southern tribe of Judah, that were, after 70 years, returned to the land. So the people that are there now are from the tribe of Judah and some Levites. We know that the Levites were scattered throughout all 12 tribes. But that is who's there today, is the nation of Judah, actually. And it was 70 long years that they had spent in captivity. Try to imagine you having children and they were born the day that you went into captivity. Now they're 70 years old. They've been in captivity in Babylon, learning Babylonian cuneiform on their little tablets, maybe. And that's the language that they know and taught and spoke and wrote. Now they're returning under these aged old men of Nehemiah and Ezra, And they're going back. They've been given a decree to go back and rebuild Jerusalem. And here we that's where we come to the place here in Nehemiah, the 8th chapter. It says, all the people gathered together as one man in the street that was before the water gate. And they spoke unto Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded to Israel. And I believe Ezra was probably maybe well up into his 80s by this time. And he's standing up there with an ancient old scroll that somebody had preserved. I believe he had a big hand in preserving these documents. And he was standing up on a platform, not unlike the one I'm up here today, above the people. And he unrolls this ancient old scroll. And the people are listening. Now, they can't read it. And they can't understand it. But he can still read the ancient old Hebrew text. And so he begins to read to them. And Ezra the priest brought the law before the congregation, and all they could hear with understanding upon the first day of the seventh month. So this was during the time of the Feast of Trumpets that we just celebrated. And he read there in the street from morning until midday. And now those that could understand in the ears of all the people and attended to the book of the law. And Ezra the scribe stood up on a pulpit of wood, as I said. Then in verse 5, and he opened the book in the sight of all the people. And Ezra blessed the Lord. And down in verse 7, he caused the people to understand the law, and the people stood in their place. They didn't move around. They didn't mill about. They weren't interested in where they're going to watch the football game or go over and do whatever, chase coconuts up and down the dusty trail or whatever. They had just come out of captivity. They were there, and it was a solemn occasion. And he read the book and the law and God distinctly and gave the sense and caused them to understand. So he would read a little bit and then he would explain to them what it meant. And it said, then in verse 9, he said, this day is holy unto the Lord your God. Mourn not nor weep, for all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. What did he read? Well, he read the first five books of the Bible, the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. I wrote in my margin, what was it that made them weep? Well, why do you cry? What makes you cry? I cry because I'm sad sometimes. I'm sorrowful. Someone dies. I hear of a beloved family member in a car wreck or something, sadness. I cry when I'm proud. When my country does something that makes me so proud, and I read of a hero in our military that does some mighty deed on his own, it makes me cry. I cry when I'm exalted sometimes, when I'm moved to tears by what I see with my eyes. Sometimes I cry in the depth of humility and shame. And I believe that these people, when they heard the words, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Some of them were moved because they had for 70 years forsaken God. They had been rejecting God for all of those years that brought them into the land of captivity, that had taken them away from these sacred days of keeping the holy days, the Feast of Tabernacles. And here they are standing now in the dust of the temple of God around their feet, the old broken stones and the dust of what was the temple in Jerusalem. And I imagine it just was a great emotional moment for them when they read of how God had rescued them out of the land of Egypt and how they had done all those things I just described, how he rescued them out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the promised land, how they once had David and Solomon as their king and they were the greatest nation. And now here they are standing in rubble, wondering if they're going to make it through till the next day. And it said, so the Levites stilled all the people and said, hold your peace, for the day is holy, neither be you grieved. And all the people went their way to eat and to drink and spend their portion and make great mirth, because they had understood the words that were declared unto them. And verse 14, and they found written in the law, which the Lord had commanded by Moses, that the children of Israel did dwell in booths. They read that same scripture that we just read in Leviticus that says that they were to make these little booths and the feast of the seventh month. They didn't have very long to plan, did they? Remember, this was the Feast of Trumpets. A couple of days had gone by and they got to this place in the book of Leviticus. So they only had about 10 days to get ready for the Feast of Tabernacles. But it says, so the people went forth and brought them and made themselves booths, every one up on the roof of his house and in the courts of the house of God, in the street of the water gate, in the streets of the gate of Ephraim. And all the congregation of them that were gone again out of captivity made booths and set under the booths, or tabernacles, or tents. For since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, of that day, had not the children of Israel done so, and there was very great gladness. And I bet it was. Can you imagine the people and the joy that they had and the of returning to God and doing exactly what He had commanded him? Like I said, one of the best commandments God ever gave. You know, and they returned unto Him. They were able to recapture the fire, to reinvent the fervor that they once had, and to repent. They actually repented here. And they recognized God's hand in their lives, in the lives of their family, the protector that He had provided. And every year they moved into these temporary tents and celebrated this day. You know, later on, the Apostle Paul would use that phrase of a tent. You know, the Apostle Paul was a tent maker, remember? And he used this term tent to give us a deeper understanding about what this day means. I'd like to turn to 2 Corinthians 4th chapter. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 6. And as I mentioned, he was a tent maker. And so when he would travel around the known world of his day, God said, "You're going to go out and preach to the Gentiles," and that's exactly what he did. And he got beat, you know, he got beat nearly to death on a number of occasions. He was stoned, he was caned, he nearly drowned in the ocean two or three times. He was out there in the deep a day and a night, he said. He was in peril in every form or fashion you can imagine. He was worried about being robbed. And yet he would go into these little Gentile towns, and he would look down and find where the tent makers were, and he'd go down there and apply and get a job. And he'd start sewing tents all week, repairing and making these tents. And then on the Sabbath day, he would go into the city and find the synagogue, and he would go in there and he would ask if he could speak, and he would stand up and he would preach. You know, he was a busy man, wasn't he? He had to work for a living. And we find here that down in 2 Corinthians, the 4th chapter, verse 6, he says, "For God, who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, has shined in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." I have this little a little clay pot that I dug up on a pipeline job about 20 years ago. It's an old Indian pot that was probably from the Caddo Indians that lived in the Texas area for hundreds of years before Americans ever set foot, or, you know, we came over from the British Isles and the other European countries to settle here in the United States. Many of them, they believe that there may have been 3 to 6 million of them in the United States that migrated across the land bridge that came from Russia over to the Aleutian Island chain into Alaska and then eventually down into the United States. Many of those civilizations existed, survived, died, and disappeared long before we ever set foot on the, for Columbus or any of the settlers ever set on the eastern seaboard. I dug up this little ancient old pot on a pipeline job. As I said, a backhoe scooped it up and it was laying in the backfill. And it's a little pot about like that. It has two handles on it, and you can still see the fingerprints where whoever formed that out of clay. And it's fabulously done. It's so thin and very light. But it was, evidently, they think that they wrapped those in some sort of leather or brush and wrapped it with all of these leaves and then put it in the fire. And they actually fired these clay pots. So they were very strong and very brittle. Of course, this one was broken into pieces, but they were big pieces, and I was able to put it back together. And it still has a few cracks and a few chips gone out of it. But it reminds me of my life. And because of the cracks, because of the age of it, because of the discoloration, because of a few pieces are missing and gone and broken. But my life, even though it's broken and brittle and chipped and banged up a little bit, inside that vessel dwells God's Holy Spirit. And that's what Paul was talking about here. He says that this beautiful light shines in our life. And he says down in verse 7, but we have this treasure in earthen vessels, just like that old clay pot. We have this old body. You know, I talk to my dad, he's 88 years old. I say, Dad, how old do you feel? He says, I feel like I'm 35. But I look in the mirror, and there's this 88-year-old man there. We are in these vessels that are going to eventually wear out. They do wear out, don't they? That the excellency of the power may be of God and not of us. We are troubled on every side. Talk to people every year at the feast. The difficulty they had of getting to the feast. We had one gentleman down there. He got there and he pulled up in the parking lot. His battery went dead and his alternator drained the battery. It cost about $700 to get his truck fixed on the first day of the feast. I said, well, at least you're here. We'll pray for you. You know, maybe we could take up a donation or something to help. Another guy's starter went out. You know, we were out there in the parking lot. A couple of guys went and got a starter and put on his old truck, you know. The difficulty people having getting to the feast. We're troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We're perplexed, but not in despair. We're persecuted, but not forsaken. We were talking before services here about your job and how people out there in the world don't understand about the Sabbath day. They're 24/7, 365. They don't understand this break of taking the seventh day off. And you now, Mr. Roberts, you can't take a phone call between Friday night and Saturday night, sundown. That's Greek to them. And by the way, in the fall of the year, I got to take about 14 days off. What? Well, I got to go and pack, and we got to travel 2 days, and then we're going to stay there for 8 days. Then I have to have a day or two to get back, and I need some time to recuperate. And most people can't digest that. They don't understand it. We're persecuted, but not forsaken, cast down, and not destroyed, always bearing about the body of the dying of the Lord Jesus. I want to go now over to just across the page there. He says, for we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved. Interesting language, isn't it? This earthly house, this physical body were dissolved. How would that happen? Heart attack, automobile accident, disease, whatever, however it may come. Just fall over and go to sleep one night and never wake up. That would be, I guess, the best way to go. If it were dissolved, this earthly house of this tabernacle, my margin says tent, were dissolved. We have a building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. What is that referring to? The resurrected body. Oh, you talk about a wonderful place to be. The resurrected body, can you imagine? How'd you like to have a body of a 20-year-old right now? Think about it. The energy you had. My son can eat 4 hamburgers. He's got so much energy. I mean, he's been gone. He got out of the high school. He joined the Marine Corps. He's gone for 4 years. Then he moved to Georgia. Then he moved to Dallas. And he just came back home here about a month ago. And I'm here to tell you, I'm enjoying having him here because he has cut the grass. He's mowed the back 40. He's clearing a fence row out for me, big old trees and brush. He works, and I'm like, where do you get all of that energy? And then he comes in to eat, and I find out where he gets all that energy. We went into the restaurant the other day, and he said, Dad, now don't say anything. I said, what? He goes, he has a hamburger. And he has a chicken sandwich. He opens the hamburger, puts the chicken sandwich on it, and puts the lid back on it, and then eats the whole thing. I was like, you got an iron stomach, you know. And then 2 hours later, he's ready to eat again. I'd love to have that kind of vitality again, that drive, that ambition, that, you know, energy that we will have as a spirit being Unlimited power. Think about it. What could you do with unlimited power? God's blessing in this day is that we are only here temporary. We're in a tent. We're in a temporary shack. We're in this little clay pot momentarily. And if you don't believe me, ask one of these elderly people around here. Ask Mr. and Ms. Kilcheski how fast their life has gone by. He just wrote a wonderful book. I just finished it. I couldn't put it down. About his life story. About all the adventures he's had. And how fast life just flies by. I can't believe. I've been pastoring down in Tyler 11 years. Can you believe that? It just has gone by so quick. My baby's 26 years old now. You know, some of you I taught before services. Your babies are 40 and 50 years old. How is that even possible? For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon with our house which is from heaven. If so be that being clothed we shall not be found naked. For we that are in this tabernacle do groan, being burdened, not that we would be unclothed. We don't really want to die. That's not the purpose. We don't want to see death. But clothed upon that mortality might be swallowed up of life. And of course, he talks about that beautiful analogy. Later on, the Apostle Peter over in 2 Peter, the first chapter, 2 Peter 1, he uses this same analogy. But you remember what Jesus told Peter? He said, when you're young, you're going to go wherever you want to go. But when you become an old man, someone else is going to lead you. Peter probably didn't understand what that meant at the time, but when he wrote this letter here, he completely understood what Jesus had told him. He said in 2 Peter 1 and verse 12, wherefore, I will not be negligent, brethren, to put you always in remembrance. I can see Peter writing this letter, thinking about what Jesus told him. He wanted them to be grounded in the truth. And he said, I want to put you in remembrance of these things, though you know them and be established in the present truth. You know the truth. Stick with the truth. You know about the Feast of Tabernacles. You know about the Sabbath day. You know about God's laws. Hang on to it. Don't give up. Yea, I think it meet, as long as I am in this tabernacle, to stir you up by putting you in remembrance. Maybe even the ones he wrote the letter to didn't capture what he was trying to tell them. Knowing that shortly I must put off this, my tabernacle, even as our Lord Jesus has showed me. He's telling them, I'm about to die. And I don't want y'all to give up what I've taught you and what I witnessed from Jesus himself. He says, moreover, I would endeavor that you may be able after my decease to have these things always in remembrance. He's standing on the very threshold of being martyred, and he's trying to encourage the brethren. What a faithful soldier. What a fantastic example. I have a whole bunch more scriptures here I want to read, and I could I could go on for another couple of hours here, and I wish I could. But I've got to read Isaiah, the second chapter, to you, a little bit of it. And then I want to read Zechariah. Isaiah 2, he says, and many shall come and go and say, come and come ye and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and the house of God of Jacob. And he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth the law. And the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, he shall judge among the nations, and he shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Won't that be fabulous? Not be watching the news and see any more gunfire or cannons or bomb blast. Over in Zechariah the 14th chapter, and I know you guys probably read this as well, but it's so prevalent. There's so many passages in here I'd love to read to you. Zechariah, the 14th chapter, says, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh," in verse 2, "for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off of the city." Verse 4, "and his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives." Remember the vision that Nebuchadnezzar saw, the dream that he had of this great image that was standing there. He actually dreamed and saw this visage that was a great image with a head of gold and the breast and arms of silver and the belly and thighs of brass and the legs of iron and the feet and iron of miry clay, iron and miry clay. And historians know, and even in the book of Daniel, it describes that when he said, "You are this head of gold," when Daniel interpreted the dream, he said, "You, Nebuchadnezzar, are this head of gold, and after you is going to come this other kingdom that's inferior to you." And history would prove, and even the book of Daniel tells us, that that was going to be the Medes and the Persians. And then later on, we know that the Greco-Macedonian Empire would hold sway under Alexander the Great. And, of course, the Roman Empire would be the final. And the description in the book of Daniel of this beast with iron teeth and its successive resurrections down through history, which would become not only the Roman Empire, but the Holy Roman Empire, describing these toes that were mixed with clay, with iron and miry clay, that they would cling together for a short period of time. But my point is, during that chapter in the book of Daniel, when he describes that beast in prophecy, he says there was a stone that was cut out without hands, and it came and smashed the image on the toes, and the whole thing came crumbling to the ground. And then that stone began to grow as a great mountain and encompass the whole earth. Of course, we know that that's describing the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of the government of God here on this earth. And that's where we're reading here in the book of Zechariah, 14th chapter. "His feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives," just like the angels told the disciples, "You men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing? This same Jesus will come in like manner as you have seen him go." He's going to come right back to this same spot, right here on the Mount of Olives where he descended, and which is before Jerusalem to the east. And by the way, do you see that picture of the... And oh, y'all haven't seen the new 21st Century Watch magazine. Wait till you get it. Maybe you got some copies here to look at. That picture of Jerusalem from almost twilight. It is a beautiful picture. As if you were standing on the Mount of Olives looking west at the city of Jerusalem. It is a fascinating picture. Very well done. "And you shall flee the valley like as you fled in the days of the earthquake and the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And the Lord my God shall come and all his saints with him." Down in verse 8, "And it shall be in that day that living water shall go out from Jerusalem, half toward the former and half toward the hinder sea." Of course, that's probably referring to the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea, that those places are going to be inhabited. "And it shall be in that day that living waters shall go," down in verse 9, "and the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall there be one Lord and his name one." Down in verse 11, and men shall dwell in it, and there shall be no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. And down in verse 16, "and it shall come to pass that everyone is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year, to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." Do you think it will ever be recorded? And I think I said this a couple years ago. Do you think it will ever be recorded? They kept the Feast of Tabernacles in Branson, Missouri in 2014. You think some old ancient people, 100 years, 200, 500 years from now, will come up to you and say, "You mean you were keeping the feast in 2014? They're going to think, "Wow. That's pretty awesome." And Jesus is going to be there in Jerusalem teaching the world to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, exactly what you're doing here. It seems surreal, doesn't it? It seems almost impossible. And yet we read these scriptures that I think are not too far out in the future for us, that that's exactly what's going to happen. And of course, he goes on to describe that he's going to plague the countries that don't go up and keep the Feast of Tabernacles. I want to close with Revelation 21. Yay! I hear that he's closing. All the kids are going, whew. Can we pick the peanuts or the M&Ms up and throw them at him now? That's what I thought they were for, by the way. Revelation 21, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the earth, first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. I believe this is probably depicting a time even out beyond the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. But it does give the gist of the subject of this day. And that is, he said, I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with man. You know, not only when that veil was rent in the temple of God, which was symbolic when Jesus was crucified, when that veil was ripped open, did the men were able to look directly into the throne room of God symbolically on the earth. We have access to God through that veil that was the blood of Jesus Christ. But also, have you ever thought, God now has the ability to look at us. He can see His light is shining from within the throne room back on us. And I think that is even another element of that sacrifice, that we have this access now, that God, not only do we want to be with Him, but He wants to be here with us. And that's what this day depicts. He said, and He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. As I said, there's a new world coming, a new order, a new government. One of the most difficult commands God ever gave us. I want you to save up some money, go to one of the most beautiful places on the face of the earth, gather there with all my children, laugh. I want you to dance and sing, eat wonderful food, lift a glass of wine, eat and drink in the Feast of Tabernacles. Remember, I love you and I provide for you, but I also want you to know that you are only here temporarily. You're just a temporary tabernacle, a temporary vessel. But upon my return, oh boy, is it going to be great. For the best is yet to come. Thank you, brethren. I love all of you. I hope you have a wonderful Feast of Tabernacles.